And so to me, like, that's the beautiful place that a foundation serves. It's a vendor neutral place that can kind of own this property, that can create like an air gap to protect the collaborators. And this is a huge thing that I don't know that a lot of people think about, is like, there is a lot of risk that you're taking on by owning the software, by collaborating on the software. And the foundation offers that gap.
Are you struggling to deploy cloud-native applications to a hybrid cloud? Do you want to become familiar with Kubernetes and Istio? IBM Cloud has a set of free, hands-on training, ebooks, and an always-on free tier of services to help you learn. Visit ibm.biz/stackoverflow to learn more. That's ibm.biz/stackoverflow. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Stack Overflow podcast. I'm Ben Popper, Director of Content here at Stack Overflow with my co-host, Sarah Chips. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Ben. How's your day going?
Oh, it's all right. Sarah, I know you are always here to share the relevant XKCD.
Yeah.
And there was a big Google post last week that featured one of your favorite
cartoons.
One of
my favorites.
Tell us a little bit about it, and then I think that'll help us transition into today's guest and episode.
Yeah. So this is one of my favorite XKCDs because it comes up all the time. And it's talking about how the entire web is kind of built on there's new open source projects coming along all the time. But after a while, the majority of the web starts using one of them. And one thing to look out for is, you know, there might be an open source project that everyone uses that the maintainer, you know, moved to Idaho to start farming. And now there's this open source project that everyone is depending on and with no one to work on it. So Google talked through how they're thinking about funding these projects and then how to identify these important projects that are holding up the web and making sure they're maintainable.
Thank you for your pull request. I now live in the woods and make furniture out of wood.
Yeah.
However, somebody must be working with the code.
Yeah, I sold this to a crypto hedge fund 10 minutes ago.
Exactly. I'm on an island without any extradition treaties. And why don't you introduce our guest today? We can chit chat a little bit and then talk about an interesting blog post that follows some similar lines about how folks can support things that they're interested in that are distributed across the web.
Yeah, super excited to welcome Miles Borens with us today, who's the staff developer advocate at GitHub and on the Cross Project Council at the OpenJS Foundation. Welcome, Miles.
Hello, thank you so much for having me today. I'm so excited to participate in the conversation.
And then also Jory Burson, who is the community manager at the OpenJS Foundation, and therefore is dragged into all of our Cross Project Council enthusiastically, I might say.
Yeah, I like to think it's fun. It's not, you're not dragged if you're willing, right? Hi, Sarah. Hi, Ben. It's good to be here.
Welcome.
Yeah.
Jumps willingly into all Cross Project Council meetings.
Heartily, happily. That's also one of my favorite XKCD comics too, Sarah, by the way. It's a great one.
Yeah.
It's a really good one. My real favorite one is the one with the Bobcat, ordering the Bobcat from eBay. Okay, we'll add that to the link. We'll add it to the show.
Add
notes.
It to the link.
Yeah. Well, related to all this, Jory, can you tell our listeners what the OpenJS Foundation is and does?
The OpenJS Foundation is a nonprofit software foundation. It's a member-driven organization, and all of our member companies come together because they find the caretaking of the JavaScript open source ecosystem extremely important for lots of reasons, you know, which I think that XKCD comic really speaks to. It's really important for us to work together to take care of the knitting, if you will, that supports our industry, right? And that's what the OpenJS Foundation does in a nutshell. And we do that through providing different programs for our open source maintainers and their projects. And we have events. We try and pull people together to work on cross-cutting problems. It's the Cross Project Council is about that. That's kind of what we're talking about earlier. We're going to open up a new way for people to get involved here really soon. And I think that's what we're going to talk about today. So
I'm looking at it here. It says OpenJS Foundation Individual Supporter Program now available. Join us in JavaScriptlandia. Put a bird on it. So tell us a little bit about this. This is interesting because of that Google post, which was kind of talking about how they were going to support things. And then recently at GitHub Universe, they announced some new ways for corporations to support open source projects that they believe in. And so it feels like this is a broader conversation that's happening in the industry. Maybe we could talk a little about why that is and then what your blog post is aiming to accomplish, or what this new initiative, I should say.
Miles and Joyce can speak to this as well. I think that similar to kind of what Google and all the big companies are thinking, Microsoft, GitHub, for example, they write these big old checks. They can, you know, write bigger checks, but they want to support open source. But also there's a lot of people out there that write JavaScript, and they might like contribute to one of our member projects or not, but want to get more involved and want to know what's going on and want to know how to get involved and how to support the foundation. So the 50,000 foot view, this is a way for people to get more involved in open source as it regards the foundation in general.
Yeah, I would add to that, you know, I think for a while, software foundations like the OpenJS Foundation have had pretty standard ways for big companies. You know, as Sarah points out, those are typically they can write bigger checks than I can. I don't have just like $50,000 lying around to give to ESLint as much as I would like to give that money to Nicholas Sakis. So instead, I give him $5 a month through GitHub sponsors. And that's great, but it's not necessarily the kind of fiscal sponsorship that, you know, a bigger company can give. But even still, as a financial supporter, you know, I want to feel a connection to that project. I want to feel like I'm doing my part to give, you know, love, and then also, you know, hopefully to get additional benefits, which in some cases the foundation provides to its corporate members in terms of like marketing programs and things like that, that we have for those sponsors. We're not talking about, you know, doing marketing programs for individuals here, but we are talking about some pretty fun ways to expand community for these people who want to get deepen their involvement in projects and do that hopefully in a way that allows them to support all of our awesome projects.
Yeah, I think one of the things that is a real challenge here is sustainability and like defining what sustainability is and then like thinking through it. So, you know, I think if you look at stuff like Open Collective or GitHub Sponsors or what's the name of the program from the Linux Foundation, Jory?
It is LF Insights now.
And so, you know, there's all these different projects that exist as a way to say, like, I've got money in my pocket and I want to put it in your pocket, developer. And, you know, I think for someone like myself who has, like, I've been working kind of in corporate open source for almost 5 years now, I personally am not in need of those specific dollars, but I know that there's a lot of independent people. And like when we think of kind of like the indies as a way of thinking of it, like where they need that support to help kind of like fund themselves. And so that's one end of the sustainability spectrum, which is like the individuals and sustaining their livelihood. Then on the other side of it too is like these very large projects are often, not always, but often not an individual. It's not like you can look at Node.js and say, oh, this is the person Node, let's support them. Node is made up of
Kevin.
Yeah, like 100 plus different collaborators, many different working groups. It's completely volunteer led. Mm. No one organization owns it. And when you think about the size of this, as if it was a business, there's a lot of needs that a project of that size has, from marketing needs, from like, hey, like we need to get the word out about the thing. PR needs, like, hey, we have found a security vulnerability and we need to figure out how do we talk to the press about this because there's press cycles. To like lawyers, like, oh my God, there's export control guidelines. What even are those? How do we make sure that our collaborators are not committing treason? Which is like, I'm pretty sure no one like got on GitHub and sent a PR wanting to commit treason. Yeah. But like you could accidentally do that in the open source world without even knowing you did. So like having a lawyer on retain or who's ready to support you, or like you get a copyright violation. Like there's all these different things that it's like if you were working for a business, from HR to marketing to all the different departments that you'd have to support you, like how do you get that kind of infrastructure? And so to me, like that's the beautiful place that a foundation serves. It's a vendor neutral place that can kind of own this property, that can create like an air gap to protect the collaborators, and this is a huge thing that I don't know that a lot of people think about, is like there is a lot of risk that you're taking on by owning the software, by collaborating on the software. And the foundation offers that gap. We have a staff on hand to help with things. We've got an amazing group of people, including Jory, that are like ready to go to help with all the different things that our projects may need. And so like, how do we keep those things running? And like corporations obviously can cut big checks, but the JavaScript community itself is this massive long tail. And a huge thing that we've been trying to figure out is like, well, like, I don't want to say how do we capitalize on that, because it's, we're not trying to like make a profit here. But it's like, hey, if there's people who are interested in spending a couple bucks a month to help us out, well, like, what can we do to offer them value? And this is one of the hardest things of a foundation is altogether, even for corporate sponsors. Like, how do we offer enough value that folks feel like they can chip in a bit?
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious, like stepping back and looking at this with a little bit of historical perspective, has the software industry been through a sea change in the last decade where the intersection between, as you were saying, corporate and open source has really shifted, where a lot more corporations are relying heavily on open source stuff that came from outside, or sort of in the reverse, creating projects internally and then open sourcing them, and a lot of people are playing with them in different ways. And that's what's creating these sort of new tensions and new requirements for support. Like, how come this infrastructure hasn't been so well built out yet? And we're seeing, you know, a bunch of people coming up, a bunch of different companies now coming up with new ideas for how to make it work. Why is this XKCD cartoon seemingly more relevant by the day, I guess is the question.
I mean, my personal take is that this isn't new. You know, that this XKCD mm-hmm. comic was relevant 20 years ago, just in a different sort of population, right? It's new to us because we mm-hmm. are web developers, and this in our space is JavaScript and HTML and CSS, and now with the web, we're able to deliver things at a scale and pace, which is pretty extraordinary. Whereas before we were talking about swapping software packages via email or hard disk, like literally mailing them, but they still in the mail. But they still have those problems then as well. It's just now it's happening at like a bigger scale. And Ben, I think, you know, your point, you mm-hmm. were asking about like the sea changes. I think we've seen a couple, and they are kind of in alignment with what you're saying, where, you know, initially it was on the web anyway, like populations of curious JavaScript developers who were coming together and sort of working on interesting problems and like creating open source from that curiosity, you know, from that space. And then, you know, you get this mm-hmm. influx of people relying on them, companies creating products on top of that, producing their own open source that they would like to get the lift from the community, you know. So it's, I think there's several interesting aspects of it. You can't just pinpoint to one.
I mean, I think what you're saying there is what occurs to me as sort of a non-developer, just, you know, thinking this through for the last couple of episodes, is that there's this feedback loop, right? Where companies want to appeal to developers, and so they pick open source, you know, languages that are popular to support it, because that way anybody can get involved. Even often at that, you know, early level, people are encouraged to build their career and their resume by doing something in that space, right? Like, before you have a job, maybe go work on an open source project is a tip I see a lot in like how to get my career started as a software developer. And so everybody within the ecosystem has these different incentives that are pushing them towards this open source idea, but right, it's still lacking maybe some of the financial infrastructure, or as Miles was saying, maybe the governance side of things, you know, when you're trying to work with it at scale inside of a corporation as well. I don't know, Sarah, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I think one thing about open source work in general, if you've done it or done it for a long time, is that if you don't have these frameworks and structures, you just start to hate it. Like, you start to hate your project, you start to resent the people sending you issues, you start to, you know, just be like, I really can't stand doing this. And so organizations and efforts like this, I think, are so important to make sure that people aren't burning out so much.
Yeah, a lot of like, I think what guides my work in community management is actually focused on the maintainers themselves and checking in on their well-being and, you know, like, what can we do as a software foundation to make your life a little better today? Because that's sort of, at the end of the day, you know, taking care of those folks who drive so much of the value in our ecosystem is really, really important. And yeah, we want to find ways to spread that love.
I think a good thing to point out here as a distinction, though, Ben, to the question that you were asking about all these different things popping up is, you know, like being a maintainer is not easy by any means. And like, especially if you're not working for a company that's like supporting you doing that work in your hours, then the question of compensation always comes up. Like, you know, I'm not doing this out of the goodness of my heart. Well, a lot of people are, but like at a certain point, like being a maintainer is not the same as a drive-by PR. It's work. And so one of the things with OpenJS that I think is worth pointing out is like OpenJS as a foundation does not exist to pay salaries to maintainers. It exists to be like an infrastructure to support projects. And while there are other foundations that do have people on staff who do technical work, the staff of the OpenJS Foundation tend to be in support roles. So it's like program managers to help make sure that, like, you know, things actually get done. Folks like Jory who are helping with community stuff to make sure that the projects have the support that they need, that they know what they have access to, that like things are actually getting followed up on. And I know that some foundations have actually had poor experiences with directly paying maintainers. And that's not to say that maintainers shouldn't be compensated. I actually think that, you know, every company who relies on open source should be carving out time of their whole work staff to contribute back. That's maybe another podcast for another time. But I did want to point out that distinction, because a lot of people, if you're going to an open collective or GitHub sponsors, you're kind of putting money directly into the maintainers' pockets as a way of kind of supporting them as individuals. Whereas the OpenJS exists much more as kind of like a neutral place to collaborate on projects and give support to those projects, but not directly compensate the maintainers.
That makes sense. So it's been so long since we've started working on JSLandia that I now forget the origin of JSLandia. It's been a fun thing to workshop with the Cross Project Council. So the Cross Project Council, just to explain what the Cross Project Council does, you know what? I say this really affectionately. It's like the bureaucratic arm of open source. And I've found that like I love open source bureaucracy in some levels. Just the things that, you know, need to be done to help the projects, different initiatives from the foundation, things like that. I believe it reports up to the board. Miles, you're on the board. Is that correct? I believe.
That is correct, yes.
And so we've been working on this for a bit. So Miles, can you tell the story? Because my story is going to be disjointed.
Yeah. So a number of years ago, when people were hanging out in person, we were at this conference, which was a thing we used to do where people get together. And
crazy. In person,
in the same place.
Weird. Did they wear bubbles?
At a location that isn't where anyone lived. It's wild.
What?
And so this particular one, I believe, was in Tahoe, but it may have been. Anyways, there's many.
It was
very
Half
nice
Moon
locations.
Bay.
It was Half Moon Bay.
Yeah.
So we're in Half Moon Bay, having some drinks afterwards. I believe Jory was there. And you know what? I just won't name all the people because I don't know if they want to be implicated in this. But we started talking about how when we merged the Node Foundation and the JS Foundation, the Node Foundation originally had 3 board seats specific for community elected positions. And when they merged, we kept all 3 seats, but the 3rd seat wasn't activated yet, and it would only activate when a certain number of individual members had joined what we were at the time calling an individual membership program. And I believe it's something like 2,000 people that we needed signed up before we would activate that seat. So a bunch of us were sitting around and trying to scheme like, well, we want this community representation. How do we get like that much traffic? What could we offer that would actually be valuable enough that people would do it? We're separately actually looking at teasing apart like and bringing back that 3rd seat without requiring this like watermark of people joining. So I'm adding that only for historic reasons, not to pressure people into joining. And so we came up with this wild idea of like, well, what if we could get the .js top level domain? And then we could make domain registration a benefit of the membership. I'm like, we'll sell 5,000 domains on day one if we let people register .js.
Yeah, I would buy Sarah.js.
And if all you needed to do was like sponsor the OpenJS Foundation for $20 a year and you would get a domain, we'd sell them like hotcakes. But it turns out that 2-digit TLDs are only for nation states. So we started scheming how we could create our own nation state, which we called JavaScriptlandia. And apparently someone's friend's father had like fought off the British on an island, which so we were trying to see if we could like create a sovereign nation of JavaScriptlandia on this island so we could get the .js TLD. The fallback was three-digit TLDs can be registered by more people. So we were maybe going to do .mjs, but we figured the JavaScript community might hate that, so we haven't done it yet.
Yeah. Wait, why MJS?
Oh, because that's the file extension from ES modules in Node that everyone hates.
Oh, God. So,
yeah, okay, also, it's Miles JavaScript.
Sarah, Miles. I feel like this is where your crypto experience is going to come in handy. You must have at least a few islands that you own.
Yeah.
Ungoverned somewhere.
We can get like 4 JavaScript electoral votes. Yeah. Yeah, we got to figure.
Yeah. I was going to say, we are joking, but it did go far enough that I actually went through and like looked through the governance of the UN to figure out like what's the process of becoming a nation state, to which it was amazing to find out how much of the governance of ECMA, the standards body that the JavaScript language is standardized at, is actually based on the governance of the UN. Through having a general assembly and executive committee, and like some of the ways in which like you add new members to ECMA is actually like a bridge version of the process of adding new nation states to. Anyways, that's what I do for fun.
It would be the most poorly defended nation state. People would be like, "We're here to challenge you," and everyone would be like,
Oh yeah. Great cyber though. I mean the cyber offensive.
You want malware? We got that malware. Yeah. We got so much malware.
Yeah.
Just sort of getting back to that big conversation we're having before, Jordy, you were saying, you know, this has existed for a long time. It used to be that you swap this stuff over, you know, physical or whatever. I guess like it was interesting to me to hear Sarah say she kind of loves the bureaucracy of some of this stuff, and then to hear Miles say, actually, this came out of the UN. I mean, is some of this, like in some ways, you know, for better or worse, the formalizing, the ossifying, the institutionalizing of open source, which I guess, you know, people have associate with like a more freewheeling, you know, anybody can enter.
Oh my gosh. You're picking up on a really important theme, which is, and there's a whole sort of group of folks in tech under like the maintainers. They have like a program called Hail the Maintainers. Like, and basically it's a continuation of that theme where there's a new innovation that comes along. People get really excited about it. And most of whatever that is going to work. Like the community is going to move on from pretty quickly, but there may be a couple of like key pieces of technology, a couple of key ideas that are very important, and they become over time, like the bedrock upon which other things innovate. And we saw that like with Grunt, the task runner, right? Which was really kind of took our community several steps forward in terms of like automated tasks and things like that. And a lot of people like adopted that pretty quickly. Within a couple of years, there were other tools that came along that were a little bit more innovative and maybe kind of were a little bit more clever or whatever, but those central ideas stayed around. And so I think, you know, over time, what happens is, you know, there's this project that comes along and it does become a staple, and something else comes along and it's cooler. So a lot of people move on to it. And what's left is a very important piece of technology like Grunt that has to continue to be maintained. It has to continue to be supported because so many people are still using and consuming it, but it's not necessarily getting that traction. It's not necessarily getting that attention that it used to get when it was the new hotness. It happens that still like 50% of developers are using it. So we damn well better make sure that it's no, can I, you know, like there's nothing, you know, critical. So I think one of the roles that the foundation plays is to continue to ensure projects like that are getting the attention and the love and the maintenance. And ultimately the goal is kind of to make it boring. Like I'm not trying to be like cute about it or anything, but you know, maintaining things is not necessarily like the most exciting thing, but boring is cool. Like boring is important, you know? And so, we're the bureaucrat. I actually take it as a compliment. Like it's not exciting.
Boring is cool.
Boring is cool. Boring is cool. Hail the maintainers, you know? Yeah.
This has been my message about electoral politics for a long time. Yeah. We want things to be more boring than they were for the last couple of years. Miles, tell me a little bit about NPM. I know every time Paul is on, he talks about how it's a cheat code that he uses on a regular basis. So for the noobs, explain a little bit about how it works. And then I know you just gave a talk at GitHub Universe. So tell us a little bit about what's happening with it now and what you were talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, like NPM is one of, if not the largest repository of software on the planet. We have just under 1.5 million packages on there and over 100 billion downloads a month. It's a lot of JavaScript. And sometimes some other things too sneak on there also. But, you know, it's cool. But the talk that I was giving at GitHub Universe is I joined GitHub in June. Switching jobs during a pandemic is definitely interesting. GitHub acquired NPM this year, and it closed, I believe, you know, like a month or so before when I joined, but I don't remember the exact dates. But so I've joined as, you know, the teams are integrating and we're doing all of the remediation work that you need to do when acquiring a company, because GitHub is owned by Microsoft. So there's like this really interesting, like GitHub has all its things you need to do and then Microsoft has all the things you need to do. And so, you know, there's a lot of work that we're doing on kind of like general remediation, on security audits, on just making sure kind of like everything is up to snuff. So I'd say that's like a lot of kind of reactionary work, while at the same time still wanting to make general improvements to the service and to our tools to show folks like, hey, GitHub's here, we're listening. One of the things that we did launch that I'm the most excited about is a new public roadmap and feedback process. So you can go to github.com/npm/roadmap or npm/feedback. And those are two places where you can come and engage with us. And the roadmap will show you at a high level, like some of the things that we'll be working on over the next couple months. And then we've also got the feedback repo where you can come and use GitHub discussions to make suggestions. And then we have these bi-weekly, although in the new year, we may move them to monthly. We're still kind of figuring it as we go. But we've been doing live streams of the NPM teams, like our leadership team internally, reviewing these discussions and talking about what we want to prioritize or not prioritize. And we're trying to do a lot of work on, as much as possible, like democratizing our decision-making process to like to an extent. We're still a company. It could never truly be a democracy, sadly, for some folks. But I mean, well, now I'm going on a tangent about like BDFL versus like consensus. But I do think that, especially for companies, there's a lot of benefit in the speed that you can work when you have individual decision makers kind of saying, this is what we're doing and moving forward. Consensus, while it's great as an open model, especially for open source, it also comes with its own costs. But we're trying as much as possible, because we're so, you know, involved in the open source world, to have a model that reflects what people are used to. It's heavily inspired by what we've done in OpenJS. And we're trying to, you know, make it so like, hey, if you're a person who doesn't work for GitHub and you have an amazing idea of something that we should be working on, you know, there's a clear path where you can make those requests, where you can get direct feedback from us, where you can go and actually see a video recording or a live video of the team discussing what we're going to do and then see it end up on the roadmap. And one example is like markdown rendering was something I talked about, where, you know, we for a while have gotten kind of feedback privately that we'd love to see more accurate markdown rendering for NPM on the landing pages. And we're actually now using GitHub flavored markdown for rendering all packages once they're published. And in the talk, I kind of go through showing how this starts as a discussion, makes its way onto the roadmap, and then comes out as an actual feature. So, you know, for folks at home, yeah, please come and join us on the feedback repo. If you've got ideas, we'd love to hear from you.
That's very cool. First of all, at Stack Overflow, we have a cheerocracy. So that's how we work things internally. And then what kind of feedback do you get from those meetings? Like, do you have people watching your videos and being like, oh, now I kind of get, you know, that I think that's one of the most difficult things when you're really invested in a product and you see them prioritize this like crazy feature and you're like, no one wants this. Everyone wants this other thing. So do you see people like watching your meetings and being like, oh, that's why?
So we've only done three of the meetings so far, and there's not been a ton of engagement directly with it. But what I found it's really useful for, and this was something that we did over in Node when we were designing ES modules, was that like by making this process more transparent, by making it something where we're empowering others to participate in it, even if it's not directly all the time, we kind of have the receipts about why we're where we're at. And so, well, we may not be getting like tons of immediate engagement on the live feeds. We are getting like a decent amount of engagement over on the discussions leading up to them. My hope is that, like, you know, when someone does come and say, hey, I have this thing I really care about, why aren't you prioritizing it? We have a lot of receipts that we could say. It's like, well, you know, we have all these other things that have come in. We had all these discussions. Here's what we have prioritized. Like, we could say we're tracking it, but like we, and this is something I'm learning as a product manager, is like, you know, you only have like so many levers you can pull, right? We've got headcount, we've got time, and we've got scope. And so like each one of those plays off to each other. So unless like GitHub's like, hey, here's 100 new engineering heads and we can talk about the mythical man month, like we have limited time that we can spend on things. So as much as we'd like to do everything that people ask for, we can't. But hopefully, at the very least, they can see, hey, this is what we're working towards, and here's what we prioritized and why.
All right, y'all, it's that time of the episode. Speaking of giving credit to the wider community, every week we try to shout out one lifeboat badge winner. That's somebody who came on Stack Overflow and answered a question that had a score of -3. Got an approved answer up to a score of 20 or more. Ooh, this one has my favorite. How do I return a char array from a function? Love that one. I love to just say that word. So this lifeboat was awarded December 8th to Margin Van Vliet. Thanks very much, Margin. I'm Ben Popper, director of content here at Stack Overflow. You can find me on Twitter at Ben Popper or email us podcast@stackoverflow.com.
I'm Sarah Chips. I'm Director of Community here at Stack Overflow, and you can find me at Sarah Joe on GitHub. Miles and Jory, who are you and where can people find you online?
I'm at Jory.com on all of the medias, on Twitter and GitHub and all of that. But yes, say hello, Jory.com.
Yeah, I'm Miles Borens everywhere, and Miles is with a Y, just to make sure that is clear. You maybe can't tell from the way I enunciate. I'm Robit on SoundCloud if you want to hear my jams.
Cool.
And yeah, like my DMs are open, but in general, like if you're not followed by me, it ends up in this like message request folder that I always forget to check. So heads up, if you do DM me and I don't follow you and I don't get to you for a couple of weeks, it's because of object permanence and ADHD, not because of you.
Fair enough.